It's good to see everybody here this morning. I want to encourage you to have your Bibles open to Judges chapter 9, where we'll be studying part of the story of a man named Abimelech. By way of introduction, I'll say that it is unfortunate that in this world of ours, we are often asked to choose between the lesser of two evils. During election years, such as this year, we hear this phrase quite a bit, especially when the election is hotly contested. Satan also wants us to believe that in spiritual and moral matters that we must choose between the lesser of two evils, that we only ever have just those two options, evil and not quite as evil. The devil would like us to see compromise at every corner, dissatisfaction with traditional religion, frustration, and a final sense of resignation at the two choices presented to us. This is why I want to study the story of Abimelech. In the text, the man presents two undesirable options to the people of Shechem. He argues that they must choose between the lesser of two evils. Ironically, it was Abimelech's own father, Gideon, the great judge, who decried such a decision, he himself choosing God over an act of apostasy. Let's go back to chapter 8 for just a few minutes so that we can get some background information to what we'll be studying today. The man Gideon was selected by God as a judge in Israel to lead Israel against the Midianites. And after a successful military campaign, Gideon is actually given the opportunity to be king over Israel. It says in chapter 8, verse 22, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.'" They're giving Gideon the opportunity to begin a dynasty of himself and his children and his descendants. But look at his response in verse 23. "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." He goes on to have 70 sons from different women because he's a polygamist. He also has another son from a concubine, and that, of course, is Abimelech. One wonders if Abimelech ever felt a sense of alienation or isolation because of his place in the family, where those other 70 sons were rightful heirs and members of their father's household. Abimelech was just the son of a concubine, a second-class son, if you will. Perhaps he had a strained relationship with his father. Perhaps he was never taught by his father the way of faith and wisdom that he had learned. He was never taught the discretion, the trust in God, that his father certainly had to earn through many trials and tribulations. And maybe that's the reason why at the beginning of chapter 9, Abimelech goes to his mother's relatives in Shechem and asks that power be consolidated in him. So let's notice chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. "So Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, 'Speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also remember that I am your bone and your flesh.'" Notice, first of all, that Abimelech goes to his family members. That's often the first place that any of us will go when we're looking for people to come into our corner of the ring, when we're looking for people who will support us in some great debate or an argument or division of some kind. We go to our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our children, because we know that they're a reliable source of strength. We know that they're a reliable source of comfort. We know that they'll stand up for us, that they'll have our back. And that's why Abimelech goes to his mother's relatives. He cannot go to his father's relatives. They're the very ones who have made him feel isolated. They're the very ones who make him feel threatened. So he asks his mother's relatives to go to the leaders in Shechem and ask a question: "Which is better for you?" Notice that Abimelech wants the question phrased in terms of a selfish choice. which one is better for you? Not what's better for Shechem, not what's better for all of Israel, not what's better for your families, and not what's better for God, but what is better for you? Be very wary of the person who always phrases things in terms of the selfish choice. Be very wary of the candidate who says, I'll do everything that you ask. I'll make all of your dreams come true. Everything that you want will come to fruition if you just vote for me. Don't make me your leader because it's better for the whole country. Make me your leader because it's better for you. Selfishness is destructive. Selfishness is not good for everybody. Selfishness, by its very nature, is only good for self. So which is better for you, that 70 sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that I rule over you, one man who happens to be your relative? I wonder, were the sons of Gideon asking to be kings? Is there ever any indication in the text that this was a reality, that this was actually a choice that they had to make? I don't see it. I don't see these 70 sons of Gideon trying to be kings themselves, trying to rule over Israel or even Shechem specifically. So the whole choice itself is a false choice. It's invalid. The 70 sons of Gideon weren't trying to be king. But that's the thing about Abimelech, is he phrases it in such a way that they believe that that actually is a choice, and an undesirable one at that. I grew up with two brothers, so I know what it's like to be in a household with three boys. We squabbled. We argued. And to this day, as 30-year-old men, we still argue over things every now and then, in good nature, of course. We love each other very much. But imagine what it would be like to have 70 brothers ruling over you. 70 brothers squabbling and arguing and endlessly debating. Wouldn't it be better to just have one man rule over you, to have all that power consolidated in one man? And I'm your relative. He's very quick to point that out, you notice. And I am your relative. So notice verse 3 now as we move along through our text. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, well, he is our relative. Yeah, because that's a good reason to make somebody king, isn't it? That's a good reason to hire somebody in a business. That's a good reason to elect somebody as president. For anybody here who's been the manager in a business, or if you've owned a business yourself, what was it like when you made the mistake of hiring a family member? Now, I know sometimes it works out okay, but we've been told many times, and I think it's a very true statement, don't mix family with business. Because sometimes what happens is you hire a family member, not because that person is qualified to do a job, but because you feel obligated to hire that person. Well, you know, he's my cousin, and he wouldn't be very good at it, but my aunt and uncle are going to be on my case if I don't get a job for him. And it doesn't always work out. And then you're stuck with that family member because you certainly can't fire your cousin or fire your brother or fire your mother. So you're stuck. Just because somebody is a relative, or just because somebody looks like you or is the same skin color as you or talks like you, just because somebody came from the same state as you, that is not a valid reason. That does not qualify that person to be king or president. Verse 4. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. 70 pieces of silver to pay for worthless thugs who will go kill the 70 sons of Gideon. Quite a touch of irony there, isn't it? Where does the money come from? But the house of an idol. It's dirty money from a dirty place to be given to dirty men to do a very dirty deed. Verse 5. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah. And he killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. At some point, did anybody in Shechem start to wonder, did we make the right choice here? We've all been there, where in the privacy of our own home or surrounded by people who agree with you on political or social issues, where you've said something like, man, if I was president, I would, if I was in charge, this is what I would do. Man, if I could just have 5 minutes alone with somebody, I'd set him straight. If I could just have a direct line to this person, I'd give him an earful. When we're surrounded by people who agree with us, it is very easy to vent our frustrations in that kind of a language, in that kind of terminology. We're bitter, we're frustrated, and we've all been there. Now, I would like to think that Christians could be above that kind of bitterness. Colossians chapter 3 talks about that, to leave angry speech and bitterness and malice and wrath and all those things behind. But the reality is that every now and then we indulge in that bitter language. And we start a sentence with, yeah, well, if I was in charge, I would do this. The difference between most decent people out there and Abimelech is that Abimelech actually is going to act on it. Most people might say that in the privacy of their own home, but they would never actually do that. They would never actually follow through with the horrible things that they say in private. Abimelech actually does, though. He is exactly as advertised. He is exactly as mean as he says he is. He does exactly what he claims that he will do. And that's scary. It is scary to meet someone who is so honest that they will actually do all of the horrible things that they say they will do. And did anybody in Shechem start to feel even the slightest twinge of regret at the choice that they made to make Abimelech their king? Did anybody hear the shrieks of those 70 brothers as they cried out for mercy? As they sat there and watched one by one as each brother was killed, knowing that at any moment it was going to be your turn next? Abimelech is exactly what he claimed to be. He said it how it is. And that can be very scary sometimes. So they make him king. With all of those sons but one out of the way, they make him king. Verse 6. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and they made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which was in Shechem. Now there was one son who was left. One son who escaped the slaughter, and that was Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal. And he's going to present to the people of Shechem a parable that is as piercing as it is practical, a parable that every single one of them needed to hear. So he climbs to the top of Mount Gerizim, and understand that Shechem is a town between two mountains, Ebal on one side and Gerizim on the other. So it creates a sort of an amphitheater. And when you're at the top of one mountain, you can speak down to the people of Shechem, and everybody in the town is going to hear it. So from the top of Mount Gerizim, this is what Jotham says. In verse 8, once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and come wave over the trees? Verse 12. Then the tree said to the vine, will you come reign over us? But the vine said to them, shall I leave my new wine, which cheers God and men, and go to wave over the trees? Finally, all of the trees said to the bramble, you come reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge under my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon." So the trees go to each of these different trees, one after another. The olive and the fig, and they even go to the vine and ask him to reign over them. You notice that these good trees, these good plants, the olive, the fig, and the vine, they know what their place is, they know what they're meant to be, and they're fine with that. They are happy to be exactly what they're designed to be. They're good. They're fruitful. They're useful trees. Being king over the trees is not what they wanted. Just like Gideon said in chapter 8, "I won't rule over you. My son shouldn't rule over you. It is God who rules over us." Gideon was happy being Gideon. He had no desire to wave over the trees. He had no desire to be king. But the trees were so eager to be ruled, they were so eager to be dominated, that they were willing to take anybody as king, including the bramble. The bramble, that noxious, useless, spiky, pokey weed. The bramble that consumes all, that wastes all, that is worthless for anything. And he becomes king. You notice the bramble tells it like it is also. He says, "All right, I'll be your king. If you actually want me to be your king, I will be your king. But be aware that there are some conditions that come along with me becoming your king. And if things don't work out between us, you will feel the fire. You will feel the wrath." Now here's the point that Jotham is getting at in verse 16. "Now therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have dealt well with him, and dealt with him as he deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian." Ouch! Ouch! That's the stinger in the side of the people of Shechem. If you've dealt with fairness as Gideon deserved, well then by all means make Abimelech your king. "But you've risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone." Now here's the thing. Did anybody in Shechem actually kill those 70 men? I don't think so. It was Abimelech and his thugs who carried out the slaughter. But look at the way Jotham is putting it. He says, "You killed them. You killed his sons. 70 men on one stone." Even though nobody in Shechem raised the sword, even though nobody in Shechem chopped off a head, even though nobody in Shechem actually did the killing, they were responsible for it. They were responsible for it in the sense that they were the ones who gave that authority to Abimelech. They facilitated it by providing him with the 70 pieces of silver. They might not have been the ones actually killing the sons of Gideon, but they were responsible for it because they made Abimelech king. Because, modern vernacular, they elected him to do it. And this point is going to become important later on in the lesson. So kind of log that one away in the back of your mind. "If then you've dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal," he says in verse 19, "then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech, and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo, and consume Abimelech." And in verse 21, Jotham escaped and fled, and went to Beer, and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. Now, I know that we could do an entire lesson on what ends up happening to Abimelech and the people of Shechem, but I want to stop right there and make some applications. Based on the choice that Abimelech had given, of choose right now what's better for you, that 70 sons or that I should rule over you, and based on the parable that is given by Jotham, presented to the people of Shechem, I believe that there are some incredible modern applications that are very hard to ignore. First of which, in a religious sense, I believe that we're often presented with trying to choose the lesser of two evils when people say that there are only two kinds of churches that you can be a part of. And you must choose one or the other. Either you can be part of a church that is doctrinally sound, that's doing everything by the book, but that is empty and has no spirit and no zeal, no emotion. Or you can be part of a church that has incredible zeal, wonderful spirit-filled worship, but that has maybe made some doctrinal and moral compromises along the way. And those are your only two options. Whatever happened to the third option? Whatever happened to the third option of just being the kind of church that Jesus wants us to be? The way that he explains it to the Samaritan woman at the well, that if you're going to worship God, you must worship in spirit and in truth. Why not be a church that is doctrinally sound and fervent in spirit and love? That's doing everything by the book, but doing it for the right reasons, with the right attitude. Why not look for the third option? Satan says you can only pick one of two evils. I say pick the right one, the third option. But let's talk about the application that we've been skirting around this whole time. And it's a big one. Going to the ballot box. I have talked to a number of my Christian friends about this year's election, and at least the way that it seems like it's going to pan out, my Christian friends are not very excited about either candidate. Both of them seem unpalatable. Both of them seem dishonest, unlikable, brash. Both of them carry a lot of baggage. And both of them promote policies and platforms that are not congruent with the Christian spirit. And many of my Christian friends are wondering who they're going to vote for, or if they should just vote for nobody. I want to make something clear here as we talk about this, that I cannot tell you who to vote for. It's not my place as a preacher. It's certainly not my place as a fellow Christian or as a fellow citizen of the United States. I am not going to tell you who to vote for. But I will say this. If the only reason that you're going to vote for somebody is because you believe that he or she is the lesser of two evils, I do not believe that that is consistent with the Christian way. Now, vote for somebody for other reasons. Vote for somebody because you actually like the candidate. Vote for somebody because you actually agree with him or her. That's your choice. But again, if the only reason you want to vote for somebody is because you believe that he or she is the lesser of two evils, that simply does not make sense to me when you look at the call of the Christian in this world and what we're supposed to be doing and how we're supposed to be framing things. We shouldn't be framing our decisions just in terms of the lesser of two evils, because when you spend your life choosing the lesser of two evils, you are still choosing evil. Even Jerry Garcia understood that. But here's the other thing. We cannot let politics get in the way of our first duty, which is to serve God and preach the gospel. Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 through 20, we call it the Great Commission for a reason, because it is our mission on planet Earth to go and make disciples of all the nations, to baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Spirit, and to teach them everything that Christ taught us. That's our mission. But sometimes we get so zealous for a political candidate or a particular political party that we allow our zeal for politics to cloud our judgment when it comes to our Christianity. It interferes with our Christianity. If you're going to vote for somebody, is that vote going to be alienating or isolating? Is that vote going to put you in a position to where you're trying to teach somebody the gospel and they find out who you voted for or what your politics are like? Are you so fervent for politics that your politics will drive somebody away. They'll push somebody away from potentially hearing the gospel from you. Don't ever be so zealous for anything of the world, whether it's entertainment or the pursuit of money or your career or politics. Don't ever be so zealous for things of the world that unbelievers would look at your zeal and be disgusted by it, or pushed away, or driven away by it. Politics are just politics. In the grand scheme of things, in the eternal scheme of things, it is rather meaningless. And if your politics are making it so that you're not able to be the Christian you should be, and to teach the way you ought to teach, then maybe it's time to drop the politics altogether. I believe that this is consistent with the things that we read in the rest of the New Testament, by the way. In 1 Peter chapter 2, notice what the apostle has to say beginning in verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. You notice that he says it is the will of God that we do right. Not that we do what kind of seems right or what seems most palatable or that we do what seems the most agreeable. But it is the will of God that by doing what is right, and that is universally right, right as it is defined and designated by God in the Bible, that when you do what is right, you will silence the ignorance of foolish men and unbelievers. By doing what is right. If you're just choosing the lesser of two evils, that sure doesn't sound right to me. That just sounds like choosing the lesser of two evils. We must prove in the way that we live that we are above reproach and above slander, that we are unexpectedly gracious and detached from carnal concerns. I believe chapter 4 of 1 Peter, verses 1 through 5, bears that out. A few practical applications as we near the end of our lesson. By all means, vote for whoever you like. And I really do mean that. There is absolutely nothing in this lesson where I'm trying to be specific about one candidate or the other. These are simply concepts that I believe should apply to our voting and our consideration of politics. Vote for whoever you like. The warning, though, is that you'd better be able to justify that vote in the eyes of God. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 and 10 makes it clear that we are going to be judged by God for everything that we have done in the flesh, whether right or wrong, whether good or evil. And I just don't think this idea, this notion of choosing the lesser of two evils, is going to hold up in God's eyes at the judgment seat. If you want to make that rationalization in the eyes of God, I suppose that is your choice. But for whatever reason you vote for a candidate, you'd better be willing to stand by that reason when God calls you to make an account for the things that you've done in this life. Second, remember that a vote is, in every sense, an endorsement. It is an endorsement of what a person claims to believe and what a person says he or she will do with the authority delegated to them by your vote. Well, a vote is just a vote. What's the big deal? Somebody might say. Okay, a vote is just a vote. I get that. But what did Paul feel like when he reflected on his vote? In Acts chapter 26 and verse 10, as the apostle Paul is thinking back on his life when he was Saul of Tarsus, enemy of the church, breathing threats and violence against the way of Jesus, he looked back on that part of his life in Acts 26 verse 10, and this is what he had to say. This is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priests, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. Now, just like the people in Shechem, did Paul ever swing the sword? Did he ever wield the club or the torch? Did he ever personally kill anybody? Probably not. And yet he cast a vote for it. A vote is just a vote. I get that. I understand that. But when your vote results in the harm of another person, especially an innocent person, you bear responsibility for that because of your vote. Saul of Tarsus voted to have people killed. So he bore the responsibility for their deaths. And the Apostle Paul looked back on that part of his life with incredible guilt. Incredible guilt. He said in 1 Timothy chapter 1 that of all people, he was the greatest sinner. The greatest sinner. Maybe the toughest part of this is the subject of abortion. I believe that the Christian should seriously take abortion into consideration when casting a vote. That if the person you want to vote for not only is pro-abortion, but supports the implementation of abortion, and would vow to protect abortion and facilitate abortion and provide abortion and pay for abortion, don't you think that your vote causes you to be responsible for that, at least in some way? Romans chapter 1 verse 32 says that it is not just a matter of doing evil, but endorsing it as well. Paul says that they not only do this evil, but they give hearty approval to those who do the same. And when you vote for somebody who is running on a platform of protecting and facilitating the destruction of innocent human life, you bear some responsibility for that destruction. So what should I do? Not vote at all? Well, one writer gives a recommendation in an article plainly called "Should Christians Vote for the Lesser of Two Evils" in Christianity Today magazine. The writer said, "In the cases when I voted for an independent or written in a candidate, I didn't necessarily expect that candidate to win. My main objective was to participate in the process without endorsing moral evil. As Christians, we're not responsible for the reality of our two-party system or for the way others exercise their citizenship. But we will give an account for how we delegate our authority. Our primary concern is not the election night victory party, but the judgment seat of Christ." Remember, a president may only last for 4 years, 8 years at the most. But you have to live with your choices and all of the attending integrity or regrets that come along with it. And you must live with those choices for a lifetime, if not much longer in eternity. At the end of John chapter 18 and going into John chapter 19, the people of Jerusalem were given their own choice. They could have picked anybody from the prison because Pontius Pilate every year gave them an opportunity as a sign of goodwill to select somebody from the prison to be released. They could have picked anybody from the prison, any criminal that they wanted, or they could have picked Jesus of Nazareth to be released. And who did the people of Jerusalem cry out for? Who did they vote for? "Give us Barabbas," they said. A terrorist. A man who participated in an insurrection that was deadly. Given the choice between anybody in prison, any old criminal, murderers and others, or Jesus, they voted for Barabbas. Never choose the lesser of two evils. Always look for the third option. Always look for the third option that allows you to keep your integrity and build up your character and have a clean conscience in everything that you do, so that at the end of your life you are not filled with regrets from the compromises that you made in your family life, in your business life, in your political life, and most especially in your spiritual life. Now, we always give an opportunity at the end of our lessons for those who have a spiritual need to let that need be known. So whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.